Shri Sunil Manchanda is a computer scientist who graduated from IIT Delhi, specializing in artificial intelligence and data sciences. In academia, he, along with Professor Adhikeshwar Seth, was driven towards finding answers in India's development story by using AI technologies for satellite data analysis in order to contribute towards data-driven policy making. He has been working in the domain of designing complex airborne systems for the past decade with AEWNC, that is Airborne Early Warning and Control System, NETRA team. He believes some of the most exciting developments happen at fringes and demand one to be extremely flexible. As a computer scientist, he was initially chosen to work in the aerospace domain of Indian Defence Research and was awarded the coveted Vice Chancellor Commendation Certificate for top position in aeronautic stream at the prestigious Indian Defence Training School at Pune. Shri Sunil Manchanda is one of the youngest director of a defense research and development organization lab, handpicked by the defense minister's science advisor and DRDO top brass. He heads the DRDO Young Scientist Laboratory for Artificial Intelligence, Bangalore, which is committed to take up challenging problems in the AI community to both advance the area as well as benefit the defense forces and the nation. He is currently driven to establish a new DYSL AI as a global research laboratory with a current focus on vision, speech, and biometric technology. It is indeed an honor for us, sir, to have you here today. May I now request you to kindly deliver your talk? I will shortly be making your presentation.
Thank you so much, Commander Bharat, for the kind introduction, and Commodore Ajay Patna as well, you know, for giving this opportunity and some time for DYSL AI to present our work and share our thoughts with the Indian Navy. It's really a pleasure having that opportunity. So I'll just share my slides. Yeah, so good morning, everyone. My talk for the day is titled as AI for Defense, some reflections on where we come from and some pointers towards new directions where we think the field is headed next. So just to set the context, of course, we are day three. So probably you all of you might already be well aware, but just to set the tone, you know, what's the real driver of the current AI boom? Essentially, it's the amalgamation of the big AI community, the biggest AI community that we have seen ever. So the algorithmic community driven innovation, the innovation that has come in hardware. So the current generation of the GPU chips that we use for AI computation, there are 54 billion silicons on a single chip. And with the advent of digital data, you have got a lot of data, but now we also have a lot of annotated data at scale, which we will see, you know, how is it making such a big difference to the current development of AI. So essentially what we're seeing on the left, the top 500 supercomputers, it's a bit dated. This is like November 2018. We are seeing a lot of data, and we are seeing the people in between, the academia and the research community, that is marrying the huge data on the right with the huge computer on the left. So this is an interesting article, which I encourage everyone to go through, which has an interesting title. You know, it says the broken promises and empty threats. And it, in a sense, captures the previous two generations of AI. So the way we put it, we are in AI 3.0. So like economy or every field, it has its own phases of boom and bust cycles. AI has seen plenty of them. So just after the World War II is when we saw the first wave of AI, or the first cycle of AI. This is probably 1950s, when the field wasn't even named as AI. But interestingly, this is when the ARPA, or the now DARPA, had got formed in 1950s. And people, especially at MIT, CMU, and later at Stanford, and especially driven by Herbert Simon and Newell, whom you will see a lot of work in the symbolic AI literature, they were able to convince ARPA, the now DARPA, that they could build technology that could rival human intelligence, that could be the world best chess player, and in next 10 years they could develop AI that could surpass human level intelligence. And this is what the funding from ARPA poured in the 1950s. And this is what we saw as the first boom cycle of AI. The first cycle of AI, we had a lot of techniques that were rule-driven. We had techniques like logic, first-order logic, probabilistic logic, propositional logic. And after about a few years, right, in a decade or so, we were far away from reaching any of the initial promises that was communicated by the community to the funding agency. And slowly we saw, you know, the AI funding getting tapered off.
And sir, I would request you to kindly click on the hide button on your screen because some of the slides are not visible. There is a stop sharing and then the hide. There is hide. Thank you,
sure,
sir.
I've done that.
Please continue your talk, sir. Sorry to interrupt you.
No problem. And the 1970s, you know, what happened is that most of the funding had dried up. AI had become a cuss word. No one wanted to invest any money in AI. And then something interesting happened. The drivers of the first boom, Herbert Simon, his PhD student, Professor Eugen Feigenbaum, who is also an AI Turing Award winner, he was invited to a Japanese conference. And Japanese are emerging from the World War II. This is 1970s, 1980s. They have few global companies like Sony and others coming in, and they are dominating the American economic market. And they had a big AI project coming in. And Professor Feigenbaum thought, you know, that if you can't sell promise, let's sell threat. And they again went back to ARPA. Now it was called DARPA, the funding agency. And they said, you know, that the Japanese are going to build AI technology. This is going to drive economy. And it is going to be a competitive factor. And US would be left out until we invest some money. And ARPA somehow again got convinced in the late 1970s. And again, we saw a second boom. But this time it was something different. Professor Eugen Feigenbaum and a lot of other researchers actually started a new kind of paradigm where they said, you know, the previous approaches of logic, of probabilistic logic, hasn't driven the results of building a general level of intelligence. So they said, you know, let's aim lower. Let's aim at mimicking the intelligence of experts. Let's try building an AI doctor. And that's where the Myosin program came in. It's during this time that the LISP processing engine got developed at MIT. You had expert systems for engineering, for fault detection, for fault tolerance. And this is the second wave of AI. But the second wave of AI also tapered off in the early or late 1990s, where the progress was there, but it wasn't as anticipated or as promised to the most of the funding agencies. And then something interesting happened in 96-97. AI community is driven by games and by competitions. That's how the spirit in the community is, and that's how the community evolves. And in 97, after a lot of unsuccessful challenges, finally, IBM's Deep Blue was able to beat Garry Kasparov, and that got a lot of limelight, got a lot of attention. And from 2000s, of course, after 2010, something else happened. And now we are in the third cycle of AI. So now in the third cycle, we hear both the artifacts of the first cycle and the second cycle. We talk of the promises of AI as well as we talk of threats of AI. And the AI community as a whole has been very proactive to tackle both of them. It's driving research as well as it's driving a lot of areas which are of concern, you know, like privacy is a concern, bias is a concern, robustness is a concern. So now we hear AI for social good. And in the same time, we also hear about autonomous weapons, or as we call them as laws, lethal autonomous weapon systems. And of course, the societal excitement, right from telephones to aeroplanes. Now, every industry talks of, you know, all their devices being AI enabled. The same thing, what is getting reflected in the research community is getting reflected in the funding community as well. Especially if you look at the Chinese investments in the American AI firms. You see, in 2010, it was barely any. It was $1 million. And the data is again a bit dated, but at the end of 2017, it had grown 150 times, rather 500 times. They were at $500 million. And the big three Chinese AI companies, Baidu, Alibaba, and Tencent, they had already invested huge money in the big US AI companies like Uber, Tango, Fab, Lyft, and others. And what has happened? Now we see a lot of policymakers, people at the leadership level talking to AI companies or research companies, we see heads of government saying, you know, that Vladimir Putin is famous for saying, you know, whosoever leads the AI will rule the world. Lot of governments are very interested. In fact, more than 20 governments now have a national AI strategy in place. And essentially, it's just a race these days, right, for getting a leadership position in AI. In fact, China has already suggested that by 2030, they want to have a leadership position in the domain. And the same thing is getting reflected in the distribution of AI startups as well, where again, the US, Chinese, and Americans, the Europeans are the big players being next in line by the Israelis. But essentially, what's driving all this excitement and all these results? Something changed in 2009-2010. And of course, AI is driven by data these days, but it's not just data. It has to be labeled data. And labeling is a pain. So what happened in 2010, Dr. Fei-Fei Li at Stanford, she came up with this big data set, which we call the ImageNet data set. It had 14 million images, which were annotated. By annotated, I mean you have a cat labeled as cat and an airplane labeled as airplane. It had some 20,000 categories. And these were very fine-grained categories, you know, like even for cats, there were multiple categories like Egyptian cat and Persian cat. It was not a car, but it was a convertible car or a sports car or a SUV. So they had fine-grained categories. And for the first time, the AI community as a whole had access to annotated data sets. And has is the culture in AI community that everything is driven by competition. We had this competition called the ImageNet Large Scale Visual Recognition Challenge, ILSVRC, which in the last, these are the results on the ImageNet Data Challenge. And we see after 2010, there has been steady progress. And if you've been a student of machine learning or AI, you know, even getting a 2 or a 3% accuracy boost is a big deal. What has happened after 2011, 2012 is that we have been gaining accuracy boost from more than 15% or 20%. And this data is again till 2014, but after 2015, 2016, we have actually surpassed human level performance on the image recognition challenge data. And essentially, what has this resulted in? Of course, then something interesting happened in 2016, which got a lot of attention, where we had the DeepMind's deep reinforcement learning algorithm beating the Korean 9 Dan. So the game of AlphaGo has got Dans, and the grandmaster is 9 Dan, and AlphaGo beat Lee Sedol 4-1. And what happened after that, you got a front page Nature publication saying that this is the scientific breakthrough of the year. After 2016 was AlphaGo. In 2017, DeepMind again made another network. They called it AlphaZero, which could actually beat AlphaGo, not only in chess, but actually was good at Shogi and chess and other few games as well. And DeepMind has actually keep that spirit of competition alive. And in 2019, an extremely complex game called StarCraft. And StarCraft is very, very close to the way actual world works. It has got a lot of action spaces. There are a lot of players. There are multiple strategies. And in 2019, they were able to, in fact, in 2018, they were able to beat the StarCraft Grand Champions as well. So StarCraft players actually spend their lifetime being good at StarCraft. And now the DeepMind's StarCraft player actually is better than 99.8% of most of these players. So that's how the performance has been. And that's how the scientific community has responded as well. Again, it got featured as on the front page of Nature. And it was actually labeled as the I think it was the runner-up for the scientific breakthrough of the year. So where does this all leads us? You know, it leads to a lot of excitement. We are seeing in the third wave of AI that, of course, there is a lot of noise, but there is also substance beneath this noise. You are seeing actual results. You are seeing actual promises that were dated back to 1950s and 60s, what Herbert Simon and Newell had promised ARPA They are getting realized now. So there is a lot of noise, but there is some substance in this noise now. So where does coming to us as DYSL AI, what are we interested in? What are the paradigms? I'll just give a brief primer in terms of what are we looking at, and also generalize into what are the other applications of defense where AI has a direct relevance. So our one strand of work has been, looking at this fine-grained work of, so of course, face recognition works well these days, right? Yeah, your iPhones and most of the mobile devices have face recognition. But essentially, we are looking at a certain paradigm, that if you have a person who is purposefully trying to evade a system, either he gets a plastic surgery done, he applies a makeup, he disguises his identity, he applies face masks or any kind of disguise, including silicone masks, which are extremely hard to detect. Where can we push the boundary? Can system work? Can facial recognition be able to sustain under conditions where even humans would falter? And these are some of the open questions in the area. So while face recognition is talked about, but most of it is cooperative face recognition. Uncooperative face recognition has also been championed by some countries, we call it in the wild, but face recognition in the wild, where the person is also trying to masquerade his identity, is still a looming challenge. So if you just look at the image in the bottom left, right, these are people even without disguises. Recognition, even as a human, isn't straightforward. So now once these people actually try to, either wear mask or apply some kind of disguise, can you still recognize them? So this is one application that has caught our attention, and we have been devoting quite a lot of time and energy to see where we can push the boundary and see whether these systems can work in real time. There was another interesting challenge with AI becoming increasingly good in creative visualizations or hallucination, if we may. Can we do age progression? Can we take a 3-year-old child photograph and can we make him 16, 15, 30 years old? This helps both in recognition, like you might have a gallery image which is 10, 15, or 30 years old. And secondly, it's also useful for the society. Say a child got missing at age 5. After 10 years, he doesn't look at the way he was at age 5. Can you actually create a photograph using the data also from his family members, say now in 2020, after 10 years, and can you make a realistic face? Now, there's another application which we have been deeply interested in is detection of fakes or detection of forgery, especially in videos and images. Deepfakes are very popular now and have caught the attention of the, especially the vision research community. You see images here where you can actually do some operations and you can remove people from the object. Here you see 3 missiles, and on the right, it's artificially inserted 4 missiles to spread some kind of propaganda, or you have this, this person just fading away from the image on the right. So can you detect forgery? People in the forensic community have been doing it for a while, but can you do it in real time, and can you do it well without involvement of humans is what the target is. Something else which we thought is very interesting is, can you work between modalities? So of course, you've got the images captured in different spectrums. It could be visible, it could be infrared, it could be thermal. And at night, of course, most of the images are captured in the infrared spectrum. Can you take these images in the infrared spectrum, and can you build an AI algorithm that could convert the infrared images back into the optical domain? So the images on the left are the infrared images. The images on the right are the actual images that was captured in the day, and the images in the middle are the images which the algorithm has generated. And essentially, these things don't work all the time, and that's where our work comes in picture. So you see, sometimes the images in the middle, it gives, some of the artifacts gets painted and some of the artifacts don't get painted. And the idea is, can you actually, as humans, we understand that this is a separate object and tree is a separate object and there's a small vehicle there. But can you actually do a semantic segmentation in real time? And can you use the semantic segmentation back to generate a good colored labeled image from an IR? And can you bundle this together and do it on edge in real time? So that's where the final objective is. There's something else which we thought is interesting, and we have taken it up. It's now, of course, there's this whole area of IoT, and we talk of Internet of Military Things or Internet of Battle Things. And Internet of Battle Things is a big concept where you have a bunch of autonomous agents and humans working in collaboration. The agents can learn from limited examples. They can sense, you know, is the human tired or is the human in fatigue? Is the human in the right condition to give a command, or they should override the command? This brings back the memories of HAL 9000. Probably, maybe not now, maybe next, not for another 15, 20, 30 years. But someday we will have modalities where we would have human-machine collaboration, and we would have operations that would be done in collaboration. So idea is that, of course, you have to begin somewhere. And idea was that can we build these nodes of smart humans as smart devices or smart sensors mounted on a helmet? And what can we do with it? So essentially what we did is, you know, that we took a regular military helmet and mounted a off-the-shelf depth camera, and we're just waiting for some other LIDARs, which are just like the size of a tennis ball. And you could mount this on the helmet. You could actually move around. And in real time, this is actually my office. You could create a 3D map of the building. And the idea is why to do all this. The idea is that if you are in no GPS environment or you are in GPS denied environment, can you enter a building? Can you go through a premise? And can you, in real time, build a map? And without GPS, from the map, can you derive the location of the person? So intention is that if a building is compromised or area is compromised, or you have to conduct an operation where there is no GPS, can you have these smart nodes which can work in collaboration? They could map out the environment, map the building, whatever they are seeing. And from these maps, can they go back and trace where the person is standing? And can they get their fine-grained positions in real time? Another area that we have been working on is voice-to-voice translation, which directly doesn't have any combat applications. And of course, we started off with English and Hindi because that's the language that most of us speak. But the idea is to take this problem and see that can we build not just machine translation, but can we build real-time voice-to-voice translation systems that work well in real time and works for languages which the military, the Navy, the Army would be interested in? This is another area that we have about to initiate work in, which is a big drone image analysis suite, where again you take images from a bunch of sensors, either optical NIR, SWIR, or FLIR images, or images from the thermal spectrum. And can you combine all of them, and can you use them for surveillance, or can you use them for, say, detecting maritime smuggling, or could you use it for building a 3D map of a tunnel which you don't want a person to cross through, or do you want these images to detect some areas of interest, which could be, you know, enemies, artillery sites, or camps? So this is what US had been doing in 2016 or 2018 with their Project Mevern. Then the another area which we haven't initiated the worksheet, but is this interesting area of multi-agent systems. It's like you have, AI community like its games. So we have this game of AI soccer, and AI soccer is actually played by a bipedal human, and you could either build your own robot, or there are competitions where you get a custom robot, and your objective is to do the path planning and in soccer in a collaborative fashion. So multi-agent systems come in place where a single person can't achieve an objective. You need a bunch of people to collaborate together and to build a strategy. And again, these systems are also divided into two kinds. They are either swarm kind of systems, or these are some multi-agent systems where in swarm, these agents have limited knowledge, but in multi-agent systems, these are akin to humans. They are fully independent systems, and they learn to collaborate in a distributed or decentralized manner and to come up with an optimal policy and see how to achieve a final objective. And this has direct relevance for areas like military logistics, for resource allocation, even spectrum allocation for that matter. In fact, it has been used in the past for spectrum allocation. or to achieve objectives in a collaborative manner. It's something in the near future, we believe that this would become a reality just in a few years, where we find a few countries already working on it, is building a smarter soldier, not building a robotic soldier, even though some people would be doing it, including us. But yeah, essentially, the idea is that can you have a bunch of nodes on the soldier? And can you have sensors on the ammunition and on the military logistics? And this is a typical application of IoT. And can you fuse this data? And can a commander actually get the state or health status of its frontline warriors? And how much ammunition is there? And where all his inventory is there? So the technology is ripe. Actually, it's an idea of putting it together and implementing it. Another area where which would become increasingly important for defense application would be AI for planning and for strategy. So of course we have like militaries have been doing war games for quite a long time. Here essentially the objective is that to play war games which are increasingly complex, but to play war games against an adversary which is extremely intelligent. So this is a work of OpenAI on top right. Where you see, right, these agents learn a policy of actually, so these blocks were just lying around, and they learn a policy that if they actually want to save themselves from these agents, they should actually get these blocks and they should just block the pathways. So it looks simple, but the idea is, you know, that beginning from scratch, can you train agents over millions of iterations of such games that surprisingly come up with policy which as humans we would which we would think are very creative and are novel, and that is where the incentive is to build war games which are AI enabled, where the adversary is AI enabled, and the AI enabled adversaries play with each other and come up with policies which could practically be used. Now, other conventional applications of AI, which have been being talked about, and there are some regulations and concerns about them, are especially laws. Laws as lethal autonomous weapon systems, where you see increasingly that like tanks have got AI embedded in them. People have now drones with weapons mounted on top of them. You have got areas like distributed AI, which we talked about in multi-agent systems. Areas like predictive maintenance, which I'm aware Commander Bharat and team have been, you know, quite successful implementing it in the Indian Navy. Especially for naval applications, areas like inventory management, using drones for predictive maintenance, for detecting rust, for seeing when a component would go bad, for maritime surveillance, for combat management systems. I think one of our sister labs, CARE, has been involved in you do sonar pattern recognition, like can you take the feed of sonar and with higher accuracy, can you tell what the objective is? In fact, both American, British and Chinese have got unmanned naval ships as experiments. I think I have a picture here, yeah. So yeah, Chinese have got, I think, Wilong II, and the Brits have Startle, and Americans have a whole range of unmanned surface vehicles and unmanned undersea vehicles, and AI-based decoy systems and surveillance systems. Essentially, coming back, you know, like after all this talk, what do we think that given all the noise about AI, given all the publicity and all this, you know, some of these superhuman results, can we say that AI is a solved problem? Is AI mature enough to go into products? Essentially, yes, but there is a caveat, and to understand that, we need to understand where the source of this intelligence is. When we talk of artificial intelligence, you know, we should always look back as the only intelligent species that we know on the planet, humans. And there's this interesting story around. So it is believed that below before 540 million years before Christ. All the life forms were very, very simple. And suddenly, after 543 million BC, you find an explosion in life forms. You find more complex organisms on the planet, which weren't there earlier. And a lot of anthropologists and people have tried to, you know, give different theories. And one of the most, I would say, you know, believed in theory is this Andrew Parker, who is, I believe, an anthropologist or a zoologist in Australia. And he believes, you know, that it was the onset of AI around 540 million years ago, where, you know, earlier the species would just swim in water, and if they will open their mouth, if they get the food, they are lucky. Otherwise, they don't get food. And initially, some species somehow, which we don't understand how, similar to a pinhole camera, they were able to get some source of light. And from the source of light, they could actually navigate themselves and go to the food source. Or if they are about to become a prey to another predator, they could evade. And we find that around this time, you know, a lot of species, it just became an interplay. Like a game theoretic interplay where the predator and prey, both of them evolved increasingly complex vision systems. And the vision systems that got developed over 500 million years ago is extremely efficient. Like, we are able to detect objects, we are able to navigate in the world, we are able to perceive depth. The first vertebrate brain is believed to be just 500 million years ago. And the signs of initial human intelligence is just 2 million years ago, which is minuscule in the, you know, the lifespan of our planet or our solar system. And the human intelligence as we know it now is, or the prefrontal cortex, it's just like 0.1, 100,000 years old. So human intelligence is a relatively a newer phenomena, a nascent phenomena in the evolutionary landscape. And the engineering principles behind this intelligence is still not understood. That how did evolution come up with, or what engineering principles what were the engineering principles of intelligence? And this is an area that has remained elusive to us. So the current level of AI technology is not akin to human intelligence. It is good at some tasks, but it fails miserably, which would be very surprising to our vision systems. So this famous example of adversarial attacks, this famous panda image, where a deep neural network, which has got superhuman performance, you know, would say that this is a panda, and you just add some noise in a clever way, and it would say it's a gibbon, a totally different animal with a very, very high confidence. And as humans, we can't even perceive what the difference is. But for machines, the way the AI systems are built, the principles of intelligence behind the AI systems are not akin to humans. And the biggest bottleneck is that we don't understand the engineering principles behind intelligence. And of course, AI is nowhere close to human intelligence. Like our brain, you know, our brain is still noisy. It has got limited memory. It can't process very fast. But it works very well for most real-world applications. And it's extremely, extremely power efficient. Like a human brain takes just 20 watts of energy. While most of the deep learning systems that we train would take about at least tens of kilowatt to a few megawatt of power. This issue of training, like most of the machine learning systems are this famous game of AlphaGo. It actually played some 450 games a day for 30 years to go to a state where it is, you know, where it could get human level performance. Areas like speech systems, it would require 2 hours of training for 16 years to be, you know, to generate speech similar to humans. Our area of visual question answering, like, can you see a picture? Can I ask some questions and can you answer? Like, who's in the image? Who's standing on the right? What is the color of the shirt? These simple questions, right, which come naturally to us. For a machine to do this task, you would need about 100 questions for every image, and you will have to train these systems equivalent to 274 years of training. So most of our models are extremely data hungry. So that's not how humans learn. We learn from probably a two or three examples. We can generalize. We have a model of the world. We know if we throw something, the object will fall down. While our machines have no model of the world, there are limited signs of active learning. So most of our learning systems are passive. like the model is sitting and you give the data, it learns and that's it. But that's not how human learns. As humans, we have this notion of exploration, right? Which of course is also mimicked by reinforcement learning to a certain sense. But we actually go out and seek in the world and discover new knowledge. But this notion of discovering new knowledge is still not well conceptualized in most of our deep learning systems till now. And these principles of higher level cognition of, you know, appreciating beauty or emotions or of course like those stuff, or even making causal inferences are still not where our deep learning systems are very good. And certainly like our systems are, so these are some of the other areas, you know, which our machine learning systems or AI systems are not very good at. And these are in fact the current focus of a big part of AI research community. Like can we do domain shift detection? In machine learning systems, we have got a training data and we've got test data. So what if training data and test data is different? What if I've seen, you know, shapes which are of certain kind and now I see a new object, which I take my system and in the field, it sees objects which it has never seen. So can we even detect that my test data is actually different from my training data? Most of the machine learning problem systems have this problem of forgetting. Like you learn one task, and now if you have to do another task, you go and you learn from scratch. But that's not how human learns. Most of us, you know, like from the day we are born till we are there on the planet, we keep learning. So this idea of lifelong learning, it's still not formalized in the AI systems. They still cannot build the goals of general intelligence where they can go from one task to another and take the knowledge from the previous task into the next task. So this whole area, we call it meta-learning or learning to learn. To learn, you know, what kind of models to use, what architectures to use, what kind of hyperparameters to use. So these are all active areas under different names in the AI research community. We either call it neural architectural search for determining the hyperparameters of the neural network. We call it AutoML, which is a bigger subset where not just neural network, but I can look at all different machine learning models and tell, you know, that for my training data or my task, you know, what would be the best model. There are loads of problems which are there to be solved. This whole area of power efficient learning, can you build deep systems? At the end of it, they don't have to run on servers. They have to get deployed and run in the field. So how do you make sure your models are smaller, they learn from smaller data? So these are just some of the open challenges, but the community itself is very vibrant. And the moot point I wanted to make is, you know, that AI is not a solved problem. AI is a problem which would require a lot of effort from all of us, from the research community, from the users, and a lot more progress has to be made. In fact, one of our recent works has been looking at, can you detect Trojans in the data? Like if I give you a model and say, you know, that this model will do your object detection very well. But what if I have, you know, I am mischievous and I want this model to fail when a certain kind of ship comes? Or say I've got a face recognition system, and when I train a system and I give it to you, and if you wear a red colored shirt or a blue colored hat, then the system will actually misclassify you. So if I give you a model, how do you even detect that this model has got, you know, these kind of Trojans installed? So these are some of the areas on robustness or on safety, which are actually critical to defense before we are sure, you know, that these applications can replace humans and can work well in the field. Thank you. And if there are any questions, I'll be happy to take it.
Thank you, sir, for such a wonderful talk. I have got lots of, your talks have been so interesting that I have got lots of questions pouring in for you. But still, I would like ask the audience to raise their hand if you want to have one-to-one interaction with the speaker. I would enable your audio. You may please raise hand, and now we'll proceed with the question answering session. Okay. We have one question from Captain Parampal Singh. I'm just enabling his audio. But meanwhile, I would like to apprise the speaker and the audience that Rear Admiral Sanjay Dutt, ACM ITNS, and Rear Admiral GS Jawanda, DGVSE, were present during this session. Sir, Dr. Smita, I can hear you now.
Yes, sir.
Member University, and I would like to also apprise the audience that we at the Center of Excellence for Big Data have an MOU with Nirmay University for working in AI technology. Ma'am, please ask your question, ma'am.
Sir, I have the question that you mentioned in your last slide that there are the certain, again, the challenges as in learning from learn. Okay. So, like, so once you identify the health of commanders or the army men during the battle, can you use the data? Can we use the data during the time of that training? Like, whatever the training given before the battle, okay. Can we use such a data to identify their health condition or the behavior or the cognitive information? Like, that's the functioning of the commanding.
So certainly, right? Because now even you've got like your Fitbits and your smartwatches, and you've got heart monitor sensors, you've got pulmometry sensors, you have
that's
got
fine,
motion sensors, yeah. Right? Yeah, yeah. So these sensors can be used to check the health.
But how? But how we can identify whether how much accuracy? Because during the time of that battle, the conditions are quite worse. It's not that correlated directly. So how we can accurate those things? My question comes into the mind. And one, how we can apply? Means we can use the graph mining or in the case of the pattern recognition, like which provide me a quite good result, because this is also one. Yes.
Nick, could you repeat the second question again? How can we apply? So regarding the first question, right? Like, during the battlefield, how to know whether the person has good health or not? That remains to be seen. So there is no clear answer. So just top of my head, what I could say is, you know, like your heart rate sensors, your motion sensors, at least your motion sensors can say whether the person is moving or not. Your heart rate sensors and your pulse sensors can say whether the person is alive or not. So if person is injured, what physiological aspects will change? We'll have to discuss with the biomedical community. But of course, there would be ways and means to detect.
Can we apply brain connectivity one? Because we have designed one helmet.
Okay. Ma'am, we would like to. I would take up your question, speaker. But we have one more question coming up now from Captain PP Singh. So you may speak now. I have his question also. I will ask the speaker. So can you please elaborate that about Project Sajjan, how the problem like pose, low resolution of light were addressed?
Sure. So if you look at the face recognition, right, there are many covariates. Like you could have people with different pose, you could have people in different lighting conditions. So you could have one image in optical mode, one image in IR mode. So essentially, how do you work with these modes? Are we have this area of so essentially what we want to do? We want the person who is in different pose, or the person say who has undergone plastic surgery, or say person. Who has applied certain kinds of disguise. We want the same person in different covariates. We want to essentially run disentangled representations. So that's how like most of our models are about learning representations which are close enough for all the covariates of the same person. So same person with different pose should have a covariate or should have a feature which are very close to each other. And features of people who are different should be as far as possible from each other. So essentially, technically what we do is we use things like center loss or triplet loss. And what we do is that features which are seemingly very different, we try to learn a model where we bring these features together. And features which are seemingly together, say you have got twins, right? They look as humans very close to each other. So we try to learn a model where features that look close together, but we know that they are different. we try to make them as far apart as possible. And yeah, so that's the way we handle heterogeneity. We handle different poses. We handle different disguises, different makeups, essentially using these kind of loss functions.
Sir, your talk has been so interesting that I have just getting 10 to 20 questions right now on my desktop. But we are over shooting time, so I will take one last question from Commander D.K. Singh. So based on your present experience on developing AI-based applications of government agencies, what is the model of engagement you would suggest to develop a pilot for Navy, especially in terms of any specific preparedness at user level before embarking the pilot project?
Essentially, I think Center of Excellence, which under Commodore Patne and Commodore Bharat is anyway doing a excellent job in terms of preparing the user agency, you know, for, because if AI has to work, you need a user agency which understands AI, and you need another agency which could actually build systems. So if something is to be done from Navy side, we would be happy to engage at all levels. And I think just the appreciation of AI systems and willingness to charter new territories would actually do the job and help us get started.
Thank you, sir. I would formally like to thank you now. Thank you, sir, for enlightening the audience with important perspectives of AI and project work being progressed at DYSL Lab. The topics covered during the session, such as journey, cycle of AI, which is very importantly, development observed in three different waves of AI, importance of labeled data, were covered in a fundamental yet effective manner. The critical projects of DYSL Lab, such as facial recognition-based Sajag for detection of disguise image and fake images, project on voice-to-voice translation, project on drone image analysis, AI-driven strategy and planning for Ministry of Defense, project on battle awareness and multi-agents project for Prabhut, were really heartening to note and made us proud about the indigenous capabilities of DRDO and DYSL Lab. We, as Center of Excellence in Big Data at Valsura, would look forward to work in joint collaboration with DYSL for knowledge sharing and developing collaborative projects in future. Thank you very much, sir, for joining us today.
Thank you so much. We look forward to serving Indian Navy in any capacity we can. Thank you.